of how others may perceive us. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. During our virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourself so we might get to know you better. And we'll also have joys and concerns during that time and then break into small groups for more discussion or general chatting. We have a few announcements. On the order of service that was emailed, you have more information and links. Just to remind us, we're sharing our offering this quarter with the Catalyst Project. There's information on your order of service. The Prairie Sing-Along is tonight and every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Everyone is welcome. Virtual Dungeons and Dragons is every Tuesday and Friday. Wednesday Fun Night this week is at 6 p.m. It's a special virtual animal visit from the Dane County Humane Society. Next week, we have a very short service because our fall parish meeting will start at 10:15. And for the links and information on all of these, you can check the weekly summary that comes out from our administrator. Then we'll read our opening words by Pema Chodron.
I used to have a sign pinned up on my wall that read, I used to have a sign pinned up on my wall that read, only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. It was all about letting go of everything.
The chalice lighting is by Michael Esselin. Go ahead, Michael.
He's muted. Let me find it here. I didn't know that I was doing
this. I thought Dan was going to read the chalice lighting too.
Oh,
it's written by Michael. It's written by
him. All right. I'm sorry. That was my misunderstanding. We'll be happy to do that.
Okay. As we come together in community in this virtual space, we are very aware of all of which we have had to let go, not the least of which at the most basic level, coming into physical presence with one another. As we light our own candles, if we choose to represent the chalice of our community, we are mindful of this sacred time of coming together on our shared journey of discovery. Discovery of that which is indestructible within us.
And Renee, you have your chalice. And we'll have a moment of silent meditation with the chime in one moment. The story for all ages is The Three Questions by John J. Muth, read by Barb Park. And Barb is going to show us some pictures.
The book is called The Three Questions, and I hope you can all hear well. We're out on our porch, and our neighbor decided to blow leaves. So this may be a problem. There once was a boy named Nicola who sometimes felt uncertain about the right way to act. I want to be a good person, he told his friends, but I don't always know the best way to do that. Nicola's friends wanted to help. If only I could find the answer to my three questions, Nicola continued, then I would always know what to do. When is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? What is the right time to do things? Friends considered his first question. Then Sonia the heron spoke. I know the best time to do things. One was plan in advance, she said. Gogol the monkey, who had been rooting through some leaves to find something good to eat, said, You will know when to do things if you watch and pay close attention. Then Pushkin, the dog, who was just dozing off, rolled over and said, "You can't pay attention to everything yourself. You need a pack to keep watch and help you decide when to do things. For example, Gogo, a coconut is about to fall on your head." Nikolai thought for a moment, then he asked his second question. Who was the most important one? "Those who are closest to heaven," said Sonya, circling into the sky. "Those who know how to heal the sick," said Gogol, stroking his bruised noggin. "Those who make the rules," growled Pushkin. Nikolai thought some more. Then he asked the third question. "What is the right thing to do?" "Fly," said Sonya. "Have fun all the time," laughed Gogol. Fighting, barked Pushkin, "right away." Let's see, we're on this page. Then the boy thought for a long while. He loved his friends. He knew they were all trying their best to help him, but their answers didn't seem right. Then an idea came to him. "I know," he thought. "I will ask Leo the turtle, who had lived a very long time. Surely he will know the answers to what I am looking for." Yeah. Nikolai hiked high up into the mountains where the old turtle lived alone. When Nikolai arrived, he found Leo digging in the garden. The turtle was old, and digging was hard for him. "I have three questions, and I came to ask for your help," said Nikolai. "When is the best time to do things? Who is the most important one? What is the right thing to do?" Leo listened carefully, but he only smiled. Then he went on digging. "You must be very tired," Nikolai said at last. "Let me help you." The turtle gave him a shovel and thanked him. And because it was easier for a young boy to dig than it was for an old turtle, Nikolai kept on digging until the rows were finished. But just as he finished, the wind blew wildly and rain burst forth from darkened clouds. As they moved toward the cottage for shelter, Nikolai suddenly heard a cry for help. Running down the path, he found a panda whose leg had been injured by a fallen tree. Nikolai carefully carried the panda to Leo's house and made a splint for her leg with a stick of bamboo. The storm raged on, banged the windows and the doors. The panda woke up. "Where am I?" she said, "and where is my child?" The boy ran out of the cottage and down the path. The roar of the storm was deafening. Pushing against the howling wind and drenching rain, he ran farther into the forest. There he found the panda's child, cold and shivering on the ground. The little panda was wet and scared, but alive. Nikolai carried her inside and made her warm and dry. Then he laid her in her mother's arms. Leo smiled when he saw what the boy had done. The next morning, the sun was warm, birds sang, and all was well with the world. The panda's leg was healing nicely, and she thanked Nikolai for saving her and her baby from the storm. At that moment, Sonya, Gogol, and Pushkin arrived to make sure everyone was all right. Nikolai felt great peace within himself. He had wonderful friends. He had saved the panda and her child, but he also felt disappointed. He still had not found the answers to his three questions, so he asked Leo one more time. The old turtle looked at the boy. "But your questions have been answered," he said. "They have?" asked the boy. "Yes, If you had not stayed to help me dig my garden, you wouldn't have heard the panda's cries for help in the storm. Therefore, the most important time was the time you spent digging the garden. The most important one at that moment was me. And the most important thing to do was help me with my garden. Later, when you found the injured panda, the most important time was the time you spent mending her leg and saving her baby. The most important ones were the panda and her baby. And the most important thing to do was to take care of them and make them safe. Remember then that there is only one important time, and that time is now. The most important one is always the one you are with. And the most important thing is to do good for the one who is standing by your side. For these, my dear boy, are the answers to what is most important in the world. That is why we are here. That's the end.
Thank you, Barb. Barb and Bob, can you mute yourself? Because there's still some noise there. Thank you. Today's presentation is What Matters by Michael Esalen. It relates to the fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. It also relates to the seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and maybe more of our principles as well. Michael Esalen serves as the chaplain for the Sims Mann UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. Two-time TEDx speaker, Michael speaks extensively to healthcare professionals, patient populations, and faith communities across the country. He's also worked as an activist and educator, addressing anti-LGBTQ bias in the larger community for over 30 years. Michael was recently inducted into the UCLA Semmel Institute Eudaimonia Society in recognition of having lived a meaning-driven life. He has 4 volumes of CDs available for purchase. You can contact him through his website, which is www.michaelesalen.com. So please welcome Michael.
Good morning. It is really a big pleasure to join you from across the country on such a spectacular historical moment as this one. So much joy, so much relief, so much gratitude. But in the midst of all that, we are still in the midst of this devastating and lethal pandemic. And as we are all sheltering in place, it seems like we're all deluged with dozens of unanswerable questions, each one competing for our limited attention and limited capacity to focus. How long is this going to last? How are we going to keep ourselves safe? How are we going to make it financially? How do we live with this kind of uncertainty? As we vacillate between one question or another, whichever happens to be working us over at any particular moment, there might be one question that lies beneath all the others. What matters? A year ago, in honor of the UCLA centennial, I was invited by the UCLA Department of Arts and Architecture to be a presenter at their special 10 questions event, the centennial edition. It was a series of 10 evenings, each one devoted to one particular question for our life and times, each one explored by a multidisciplinary panel from across the university. When I told my husband, Scott, about this honor of having been invited, he, of course, asked me, "What's your question?" "What matters?" I said. "Oh," he said, "everything and nothing." And then he left the room. Pithy, yes, but also true in a way. Everything matters and nothing matters. Our own individual lives, such as they are in this moment, are indeed a compilation of the countless decisions we have made over the course of our lives, both large and small, decisions that were informed and shaped by our idea of what mattered at the time. Do I marry this person or not? Do I live in this city or not? Do I pursue this career or not? Or on a whole other dimension, do I buy this new pair of shoes or save my money? Do I eat that last piece of chocolate cake or let it pass me by? Each decision was shaped by our idea at the time of what matters. On a national level, we only have to look 1 year ago to our Democratic national primary debates to get a cross-section of what matters. Day one of my presidency, we're going to be addressing the healthcare crisis. No, for me, my primary priority is climate change. For me, it's the corruption in Washington or the catastrophe happening at our southern border. And it all matters. But look at what happened in the span of so few months. All of that had been trumped, you should pardon the expression, by the COVID-19 pandemic. Does that mean none of that matters anymore? Of course not. It just means that this has captured our attention now. On a whole other dimension, do you know what else matters? That you get home safely from your next trip to the supermarket, that we have cat food, that Rupert has been fed, or that I have milk for my oatmeal tomorrow morning. I think ultimately what matters is this very moment, the thing that's right in front of us. I remember in the early 80s reading a magazine interview with Rosalynn Carter. This would have been not long after she and Jimmy had moved out of the White House back to their home in Plains, Georgia. At the time of the interview, she was busily engaged in laying a new brick pathway up to the front stoop of their house. She commented to the interviewer about how astonishing it was to reflect that just very few months ago, she and Jimmy had been living in the White House, hosting state dinners, Camp David Peace Accord, all of that. And now the most important thing in the world is that this brick is straight. And it matters, she said. Though I was such a young man, I was so struck by the profundity of that, so much so that it still sticks with me 40 years later. It's almost Zen-like, isn't it? Around the same time, I remember taking some kind of self-development seminar or another. After all, it was the 80s, in which we were given the task of writing our own epitaph. Now, if you've never tried that, it can be a daunting experience, but also illuminating. It also becomes even more daunting when we have to do it for real. My mom died a year ago, April, and there's only so much room on those little bronze plaques. Which few words are you going to choose to summarize, to encapsulate an entire human life? What I chose for myself in my early 20s was, he was moved by life. I think what matters is really quite fluid and changeable over the course of a lifetime, maybe even over the course of an afternoon. What mattered to me at 25 is not what mattered to me at 45, which bears little resemblance to what matters to me today at 65. I think in the first half of life, we are so consumed with pursuing our goals, accomplishing something, achieving success, maybe starting a family, success, as if we have the vaguest idea what that means. The second half of life, I find, is a different story. But one inescapable truth for all of us is that a couple of generations from now, no one will know or care or remember that you even walked the earth. So given that reality, what matters? I have to come back to Rosalynn Carter, that the bricks are straight. And yes, while I'm focusing on the brick of this moment, I have to be mindful and attuned to all the enormous problems that plague our world. But when it comes time for me to take my last breath, what will I say matters then? In my role as an oncology chaplain, I would say I'm sort of in the coming out business. I'm creating a safe space for people to come out to me, to tell me their truth, often their deepest truth, and often at the most critical time of their lives, at the end of it. But the way I see it, it's not only a coming out business, it's also a meaning-making business, because once that truth is out there on the table, how do we hold it? How do we contain it? How do we make sense of it? That's part of the gift and exhilaration of getting to do this work. Every day, I get that constant reminder, Michael, pay attention. Particularly as I move well into the third act of my life. When I think back on Acts 1 and 2, I realize how seldom it was that I was ever focused on the brick in front of me. I always had my eye around the corner to the next brick. What's the next thing? How does this decision affect that one? What classes do I take? What do I major in? Which college do I go to? Which career do I pursue? Which relationships do I nurture and pursue to somehow get me closer to wherever it is that I think I want to go? And of course, that's still kind of true in a way, but maybe with less urgency. But then again, perhaps with more urgency, because at this stage of my life, the big what's next for me now is the home stretch, the final reckoning, as it were. So when it comes time for me to take my last breath, what will I say matters then? Of course, there are as many answers to that question as there are people on the planet. And still, I hear common themes from folks who are wrestling with that very question when deciding whether or not to sign up for guaranteed more suffering with the next drug trial, chemo treatment, radiation, or surgery. What makes life worth fighting for? Well, I'd like to see my son graduate high school. I'd like to live long enough to see my daughter get married or my grandchildren be born. Still, I find those to be deceptively simple and tidy answers, seldom revealing the larger picture. Many years ago, I worked on the bone marrow transplant unit at UCLA. Leukemia and lymphoma patients mostly, who often spent many weeks, if not months, in the hospital. And there I met Leon, who was a difficult, prickly guy, not at all likable. In all of his weeks in the hospital, I never saw that he had a single visitor. And he almost seemed proud of that fact. "I don't need anybody," he would say. He had his own business and he had a dog who scared the neighbors. Leon identified as an atheist, a secular Jew, and he presumed I was religious and a Christian, neither of which are true, but he used to enjoy duking it out with me, philosophically speaking. So that was the nature of my spiritual care, engaging in these theological discussions with Leon. Once he had his bone marrow transplant, things went south very quickly, and the doctors came in with that awful news. "There's nothing more we can do." And then the heart began to soften and the tears came. But the very next day, the doctors came in and said, "Wait, we think you might qualify for this brand new drug trial." Oh, his spirits went through the roof, mine too. "Leon, this is great news. Tell me, what are you going to do with more time if you get it? I eagerly wanted to know. Here's the very nexus of it. What matters?" "I'd like to finish my invoicing," he said. My heart just sank. In total judgment, I admit, I was not a good chaplain in that moment. I did not ask the next obvious question. "Oh, really? That's interesting. Tell me, why is it that your invoices mean so much to you at this point?" No, I just kind of sat there in stunned silence. I guess I was hoping he'd say, "I'd like to walk my dog on the beach one more time. I'd like to see one more beautiful sunset. I'd like to hear Rhapsody in Blue one more time." "No," he said, "I'd like to finish my invoicing." That's where he found his meaning. That's what mattered. Marianne, in her 40s, had lived the past several years with pancreatic cancer, and I walked the last few months of her journey by her side. Not long before she died, I went to see her in the hospital, and she was hooked up to every kind of tube and pump and hose imaginable. She was absolutely fried, just cooked. "I'm done, Michael. I don't want any more. I'm ready to leave." But it wasn't an option. Her husband and her kids, of course, wanted her to keep fighting, have the next surgery, try the next drug trial. "Let's get a second opinion, a third opinion, a fifth opinion." "I can't die having them think for the rest of their lives that I didn't love them enough to keep trying. Do you think that's what they're going to think of me, Michael?" "Marianne, what would you want right now if you could call the shots?" "That's easy," she said. "I would disconnect all of this. I'd ask my husband to get in bed with me and hold me and look out that window across my room at the tree across the street and say, 'Look at those leaves. Look at how they capture the light and they flutter in the breeze. Isn't that beautiful? A God moment, she would call it. Over our months of conversation, she had told me about other God moments that she had had, moments that sort of anchored her into life, moments in which not much really happened, in which the stuff and business of life just fell away, leaving space for awareness of this moment being beautiful and being enough. I'd like one more God moment, she said. I met Evelyn on her first day of chemotherapy after being newly diagnosed for ovarian cancer. And she came to see me every 2 weeks for the next 6 years. Although she never wanted to talk about anything of any deeper consequence than what she and her husband Gene had done the previous weekend. Despite all my invitation, holding the door open to talk about the deeper themes and questions that are coming down the pike, she never took the bait. I didn't feel like I was doing much of anything, but she would conclude each visit by saying, "Oh, Michael, thank you so much. I always feel so much better just talking to you." I went to see her in the hospital the day before she died. Her husband, Gene, was there, of course. They'd been married just forever. No kids, though. High school sweethearts. The Buddhists believe it's a good idea to be reflecting on the sweet memories of life when one is about to make their transition, that somehow maybe it greases the wheels for the next incarnation. No matter what our beliefs are about such things, it is not a bad idea. So I asked Gene, "Tell me that story again about how you guys met. I love that story." And he launched into the story, and soon enough, Evelyn was getting a little irritated because she didn't remember. Undaunted, Gene pressed on. "Sure you do, honey. Remember we went to that football game and we were in the back seat of that car?" And now she was getting very distressed because the memory was gone forever. Gene changed course and said, that's okay, honey. Maybe you're just tired and want to sleep. Tell you what, Michael and I will go out in the hall and we'll chat a bit, give you a chance to rest. How about that?" "No," she said defiantly. "I'm not tired. I don't want to sleep. I want you both here. I just don't want anybody to talk." And so I got on one edge of the bed and Gene sat on the other, and we each held a hand and we just sat there in silence, just looking at each other, nothing to do, nothing to say. Just the awareness of love, of presence. And for the rest of my life, that moment has imprinted my heart with what truly sacred space looks like. And just maybe the thing that matters most is what's left when everything that we thought had mattered so much has burnt away. So what matters to me today? This conversation matters. Kindness really matters. Friendship, love, of course, humor, kinship, being a witness to one another in our lives, that matters. Communion, an old-fashioned religious word, but I love it, and the imagery of it, taking in and digesting our common humanity, the thing that connects us to each other and to nature and to the source of life itself, that matters. Sure, I'd like to think when I'm breathing my last breath that I'll think that I made a difference, that I relieved some suffering here and there, I provided some encouragement, that I had a blast, that I saw the world, that I loved hard. But I'm not so grandiose as to think it was ever anything more than one conversation at a time, one brick at a time. We go through our lives having so many interactions with so many countless numbers of people, a little encouragement here, a little inspiration there, a laugh here, those little contacts might have the greatest impact of anything that we do in our lives, all those things that we thought were so important. They, in fact, might be our greatest legacy. Joseph Campbell believes it's important to realize the eternal within, that we should participate with joy in the sorrows of the world. I love that. I come back to it again and again as a kind of a mantra, to participate with joy in the sorrows of the world. I don't know. Maybe it just comes down to being moved by life. So be it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We do have some time for discussion. I had a question or thought, which one of the most difficult things in these last months is people not being able to be physically present with their loved ones as they're ill or dying. And I think that in many places, chaplains are not able to do that either. Or if they are, they would have to be in hazmat suits. And
yes.
Do you have anything to say about how we cope? I know that some doctors and nurses have gone way out of their way to be that person for someone who didn't have anyone else there.
I am, yes, it's a tragedy of our times. And while I'm not a hospital chaplain, we are the Sims Mann Center, we are on the outpatient side. So I'm providing, before the pandemic, I'm providing support to people in infusion clinics, or they come meet with me as they would a therapist, or when I'm in the clinic, a doctor might pull me over and say, I'm about to give a patient bad news. Can you come in and be ready here? So it was still face-to-face, but it wasn't in a hospital. If a patient got sick and went to the hospital, I would go see them in the hospital. But the primary basis of my work is in an outpatient setting. Right now, I'm totally on Zoom all day, having sessions with patients. And it is terrible. And it's not remotely the same thing as being there. You're not even making authentic eye contact. The patient's looking down at their computer and you want them to look at you. And yet, you can't touch them. You can't hug them. You can't hold their hand. And then the sound's going out and there's lack of synchronization. I have a patient that I see for bereavement support, and it was ridiculous. Her emotions are very volatile, as you might imagine. And my computer screen showed her laughing. She had said something that was funny, but I'm hearing her cry. So I'm like a week behind here. How am I supposed to be responding? And what is she seeing? It's not authentic communication. It's the best we got. So how do we listen? How do we create that presence against all of these barriers? And some of it, much of it might be in the same way if you travel to a foreign country and you can't speak the language, what do? You use your eyes, your heart, you hope that your intention is going across this barrier where there's no language, no articulation. Can the heart speak? It's kind of similar to that. How do we do that for each other? Yeah, Zoom is a tool, but it's a flawed one, but it's the best we got. We do have the phone, but these are really hard times. And to really rely on other modes of maybe multidimensional communication that aren't just words in time and space.
Well, thank you so much. If people have questions or comments, you can raise your virtual hand and see, Renee, you'll
People generally can unmute themselves, but we're looking for hands on your computer if you want to ask a question. Everyone's still stunned by the amazing talk that you gave, Michael.
Well, I hope that's true and not bored out of their minds.
Oh, I see Steve.
Can you say more about how you are with someone who doesn't want to talk, doesn't want to share what's on their heart, what's going on in their head?
My role is to, and for any person who's pursuing compassion, as far as I'm concerned, is to be where the person is. I might meet a patient in the infusion clinic, their first day of chemotherapy, they're stressed out of their minds. They were just diagnosed maybe 2 weeks ago, their world is upside down, their head is spinning. And they're going into orbit about trying to find a parking place in the parking structure and how much the parking costs there. That's, I come to them where they are. Isn't it awful? Yeah, I know. To be where they are, to be a witness, to be seen. I've got two kind of illustrations. One is a movie that came out, I don't know, 10 years ago. At this age, everything was 10 years ago. It could have been 15, it could have been 30, it could have been 5. But it was called Little Miss Sunshine. I don't know if you saw it. Hysterical movie. This family is driving across country. It's very comical. And they're in the middle of the desert somewhere. And their teenage son, whose dream is to be a pilot, discovers reading a magazine that he's colorblind in one of those little colorblind tests, which there goes his dream out the window. He jumps out of the car. He goes, runs in the desert. And the mom doesn't know what to do. And the little girl, Olive, is this sweet kind of dorky little girl. And the mom says, Olive, go talk to your brother. And she goes next to him and just sits there, does not say a word, just sits right next to him. And after a while, she just kind of nudges him, leans into him like that. And then he says, okay, let's go. That's a time of perfect compassion. Just being, compassion just means to be with suffering. It doesn't mean fix it, advise it, say something positive, compare it. You should be grateful because just to be with it. And it's not an easy or small thing. I do a lot of speaking. And years ago, I spoke at this cancer support community out in a suburb of Los Angeles to mostly cancer patients. And there was Q&A afterward. And this one woman asks me, what's the meaning of life? As if I have that answer. She doesn't wait for my response. She wants to tell me her answer. And she says, I think the meaning of life is that everyone wants to be known. Not as in famous, but as in seen, witnessed. And at the time, I remember my judging mind going into overdrive, thinking, well, that's way too simplistic of an answer, but thank you, dear. Is there another question out there? But I've quoted her 10,000 times in the years since, because I think she came close to hitting it right on the money. Just being seen, seeing ourselves and seeing each other without the judgment, without just, I see how hard your life is. So if somebody you know is holding pain or maybe they're talking about harming themselves or something, but they don't want to talk, can you be still and just be with them? And wherever they are, you go with them. Could you believe Stephen Colbert last night? Yeah, what'd you think about this? Well, tell me about it. I didn't see it. Make the connection is the sacred piece, not any wisdom you've got. You're not in their shoes. You don't know what they're going through. Not really. So can I be a student of theirs? Tell me, what's it like to be you? How can I sit with you and hear you and understand you?
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have a couple more people. Kent?
So I guess one thing that occurred to me that I was wondering about is, you know, if something happened where somebody, the doctor said to me, oh, you've got such and such cancer, you've probably only got 6 months or a year or something like that. Probably 90% or something of what I would want to do in that situation is impossible now because of COVID. And I'm just, you know, sort of wondering if that's kind of a big factor also for a lot of other people and kind of what people are doing to deal with that limitation in terms of end of life scenarios.
They're suffering like we all are suffering. They want to hug their grandchildren. For a lot of people that get to a certain age, their grandchildren becomes a centerpiece of their lives and they can't see them. They can't hug them and they're dying. And so it's sad. There's no way to say, well, let's look at it this way, or at least you've got that. Again, how can I be present? It becomes a spiritual crisis. I feel like I'm in a spiritual crisis. I'm an extroverted person that I get my connection from being with people, not on Zoom. I had to go into work for a meeting and there's a maintenance person in the elevator go, oh, a person, how was your day today? I mean, the most inconsequential conversation just gave me oxygen. I love travel more than anything. I love going to the theater, cabarets, concerts, socializing, going to movies. All of that's taken away from me. I going swimming every day at the gym. Those are the things that keep me afloat spiritually, counterbalance all of this suffering. It's not available to me. It becomes a spiritual crisis. How do I be present in it? Try to find other sources of oxygen. It's not the same. There's no shortcut around the suffering. So how do I put faith in the idea, like the Pema Chodron quote, am I getting annihilated so I can discover what's truly indestructible within? If I can make peace with that as the process I'm in right now, rather than how do I get the same buzz I used to get from going to see a great film, that's a higher goal. I'm not remotely there, but I do see that as my task.
Catherine, I think you can unmute yourself.
This was a hard one. I've had to make a lot of decisions recently about what matters to me as far as relationships go. And then a couple of days ago, the mom of someone I've known since fourth grade died of cancer. And she gave me a plant. Mm. It used to be pretty small, but it's now in two pots. Mm. I wish I'd told her that I still have the plant.
Mm. Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry. And it is so, your sharing is beautiful. The story is beautiful. The imagery of the plants growing and flourishing is beautiful. Does it make it hurt any less? Of course not. I think we need to let go of the idea that the goal is to hurt less and that life is always supposed to be joyful and pleasant. And it's just not, it's not built that way. We're all going to lose everything, everything we have, everything we love, everything we are. We're all going to lose it, guaranteed. So does that mean that we ultimately fail? Some would say yes, you know, some, interestingly enough, I find that super religious people, evangelical Christian, most particularly like in a end of life situation in an ICU where someone is so far gone, I mean, maybe brain dead or their skin's so weak it's falling off if you touch them, and the family saying, no, we cannot allow a natural death here. We have to give God a chance to do a miracle. Interestingly, when the faith tradition is based on the whole idea that it gets better on the other side, often those folks are the most to try every scientific measure possible to keep cells alive. I remember a family who asked me, you know, we have to give God a chance to do a miracle. And I kind of took a risk and just said, what if death is the miracle? If birth is a miracle, and everybody seems to say that, isn't it a miracle, new life, then by definition, death has to be too. It just has to be. It's a mystery. You were here, and then you're gone. What happened? Where did you go? Are you still there? Were you here, really? I'm so sorry for your pain. And that you couldn't be there to hug her. This is a tragedy. This is a tragic situation.
Catherine, thank you so much for coming to us and sharing that with us. Some of us have the honor to know Catherine since she was maybe 6 years old.
Oh, gosh.
It's really great to see you from college, from one college that has been successful in meeting in person. So
I'm glad that you're Indiana there right now.
You what, Catherine?
I'm in Indiana right now.
Okay. I am so sorry for this loss.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else?
I can't put my hands in.
All right. We'll have a closing song by Dan Proud.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird.
Thank you. And thank you so much for Michael. This has really been meaningful for everybody. And just to clarify, you are going to lead us in this in the next the closing yeah. section, right?
Yes. Okay. Well, I invite you to perhaps close your eyes where you are and take a few nice deep breaths with me. And breathing in the love, the intention, the commitment of this community to come together and to connect, despite all that there is now to separate us physically. As we exhale, can we release the light and the radiance of our coming together, not only back to one another, but to the larger circles of life? Let's even stretch our arms out right now where you are and imagine our embrace of each other and those larger circles of life, getting a sense of our connectedness in a place beyond time and space. Despite the physical isolation of this moment, as we breathe into that embrace, let's absorb the words of the poet Rilke as a blessing to ourselves. Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given to you, because you would not be able to live them. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. So be it.
Thank you again. Thank you again, Michael.
Thank you.
And to everyone who attended.